Melissa, do you believe in coincidences or otherworldly? Do you think everything happens for a reason?
I don't know. I my cynical side says no, but sometimes I think maybe.
Okay, because two things happened today, two completely unrelated events. So whenever we release a new episode, I like to watch the episode the next morning. Something about it, I used to do this in my shows too, like something about, you've seen it 100 times, but something about seeing it on YouTube, on TV, like just watching the finished product, right?
That makes sense.
So this morning I sat down with my cup of coffee, was listening to Rob's interview, and we got to the part about the sad airplane story where they were all on the plane with David's remains and people were coming up to him. So I have in my living room, I'm not sure if you've ever seen it, it's called a Clido clock. It's the coolest freaking clock ever made, hands down. Basically, it's an LED clock that changes faces. It has these
I've seen that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm going to put this up on screen, but I'm going to send you something right now that you can look at.
Oh, I dropped my phone on the ground, so hold on. Oh, that's creepy.
Right?
It's probably
of all the clock like faces.
Yeah, but it's probably like your phone. It can probably hear you.
No, there's only so many clock faces built into it. It's not just it's not an Alexa. That was the first thing. And secondly, this is going to be a shout out to a listener, Michaela. So a friend of ours,
she
was listening in the car and she sent me a picture. She's like, yo, you will not believe what I'm so she's at a light. There's a blue van, creepy blue van sitting at a light. Like, when's the last time you've seen a blue cargo van with like a stripe on the side? So if you think David's not looking over us, you're, I don't know how else to explain it.
Super cool.
It's Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
What is up, crime crew? Welcome to another episode of Murder Unscripted, the most immersive podcast on the internet today. I'm your host, Ed Hydock, here with my bestie, Melissa Spivey.
Heyo.
What episode is this? 67? 68?
We're supposed to be keeping track, and I just realized we haven't been. Did I put it at the 67. Top? No, I didn't.
No, I'm going to call it. We're in episode 68, I think. So
we think.
So before we dig in, I don't want to remind everybody that, like we said last week, we are going to be starting a Patreon in January 2026. So kicking off the new year in style. Mm-hmm. So it's still in the works. So if you have any ideas for us, please send them our way. So things we can do, case suggestions, anything that you guys want to hear, now is your chance to have your input heard.
Yeah, tell us what you guys want. Otherwise, it's going to be what Ed and I want, and you know it's going to be a bad decision.
It may not even be crime at this point. All right. Well, we are not messing around today because we have a pretty incredible case to tell you about. And I'll mention that it is going to be a two-parter. So we sometimes have to do this if a case is too crazy or too involved or too massive. And this is part of September's The Case That Haunts Me block, where we are covering crimes that left a humongous impact on investigators, on the crime scene techs, on the first responders, the medical examiners. The list literally goes on. These are people that often go overlooked. The people who do this for a living. Like dealing with murder day in and day out. Can you even imagine? They're sometimes the first people to lay eyes on the worst of humanity before the homicide detectives even get there.
Well, and if you really think about it, they see someone's worst day of their life every day.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And I think to witness that every day, day in and day out, would be so emotionally like exhausting.
Draining. Yeah.
Yeah. And our case today is no exception. Honestly, it's a case that has haunted not just the families of the victims, but also the investigators that have spent literally 30 plus years working on it, the news reporters that have spent their careers following it, and frankly, the entire city of Austin, Texas is still haunted by this crime.
Yeah, I'd buy that.
If you can't tell by now, we are digging into the yogurt shop murders.
So I love two-parters. I like having to wait to find out what happens. But then again, I'm also used to like skipping ahead on Netflix, like right to the next episode. So that's not really waiting, I guess. That's being in suspense for like 38 seconds.
To be fair, I hate two-parters because I like to know, like I look up the movie ending before I go to the movie. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Why would you even pay for the movie then?
Most of the shit that comes out of my mouth is the stupidest thing you ever heard.
That's kind of true. I don't know. What do you guys think? Do you like two-parters? Or do you like us kind of cramming everything into 1 hour so that you can digest your case in one fell swoop? Let us know. And on the let us know front, while you're at it, if you could please take a moment to like, subscribe, rate, do all the things, especially on Apple and Spotify. That would be a humongous help, and we would truly appreciate it. So apologies, Melissa, with that out of the way, take it away.
All right. Well, for me, this is one of those cases that is on my to-be-solved wish list, so to speak. And I've known a lot about it over the years, but Sue actually did us a huge solid, and she took a month-long deep dive into the case to help get these episodes together for us.
Yeah, she was hugely helpful.
So helpful. We dug into the book Who Killed These Girls by Beverly Lowery. We watched the new HBO Yogurt Shop Murder docuseries, and we went through a ton of coverage by the 48 Hours team. And I'm actually really thankful to Sue for taking the lead on this case, because I'm going to be honest, I started watching the HBO Max documentary and I was crying about 6 minutes into it. Like, it was so incredibly jarring to see how 34 years later, these seasoned investigators are still so effed up from this crime. And it really is the crime that changed Austin, Texas forever.
We talk about these crimes affecting small towns all the time, but big towns have the same thing happen to them. I don't care if the city has 5,000 people or 150,000 people. It's going to linger. And the memories of these crimes are going to stick with the people that live there, especially if they were there when they happened.
Well, to get started with this case, we need to talk about Austin, Texas back in 1991. So we're back in the 90s this week. I'm feeling good. Well, I think Texas is one of the few states in the United States that has always carried its own reputation. Back in 1991, Dallas had a population of just over 1 million, while San Antonio, home of the Alamo, had just shy of 1 million people living there. Austin, it kind of ended up being like a little sibling city with a population of just about 500,000 people. And while the hit TV show Dallas spent 13 seasons showing the rich and fancy lifestyle that came from oil money, Austin was much more of an eclectic college town. In 1993, the amazing movie Dazed and Confused would enter our lives, and while it was set in the 70s, it was filmed in Austin, and honestly, if you just change the dates and their clothes to like 90s clothing, that's what Austin was like. Teenagers worked, they hung out, they drove around, smoked a lot of weed, alcohol, all of the good stuff. But just teenagers doing the things, all the things.
I mean, don't you miss those days, like just a little bit?
Not much has changed. Well, the city of Austin was vibrant and rich with live music, at the time being called the live music capital of the world. The now infamous South by Southwest Festival was on the rise, and actually Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II even visited Austin in 1991.
Wow, la-di-da.
I know. Well, Austin, like most Texas cities, also still had solid roots in like the ranching and the cowboy way of life. But it also had this counterculture that was kind of a mix of grunge and punk rock, leading to the term PIB.
The Press Information Bureau? What does that have to do with anything?
What? No. Meaning people in black, PIB.
What the hell is that expression?
Apparently they used to describe the teens and 20-somethings that like embraced that style of clothing. Like that's what they called them.
All right. The PIB I'm talking about is literally a government news agency in India. I'm guessing it's not that.
No, it's not that one.
How edgy.
Right? So just before midnight on December 6, 1991, an officer was driving past a strip mall on Anderson Lane, and he noticed smoke coming out of one of the closed stores. So he radioed the fire department, and Austin Fire Department responded, and they aggressively attacked this fire. Because remember, this is a strip mall with multiple stores connected to each other. And it was a cooler evening, like low 60s and kind of damp and misty, but there was the stillness in the air. Mm. And we all know that fires can spread really, really quickly. So the AFD didn't want to take any chances.
Right. Especially on strip malls. I mean, that'll wipe out the whole strip.
Exactly. So once the fire was out and it was safe for firefighters to enter the building to check that all the embers were out and to investigate the cause of the fire, they quickly stumbled across a horrific scene none of them were prepared for. So while the AFD was responding to the fire call, Homicide Sergeant John Jones, he was actually out on patrol, ironically with the news crew in the car with him as they were doing a segment on the crime in Austin when he got a call on the radio. And I guess he was like talking to the crew because he missed the first sentence that came over the radio. And he was confused when he heard the request for him to show up for a fire. He's like, what? Why?
Yeah, why would I be assigned to that?
Right. Well, then the dispatcher repeated, we have three bodies. And Jones was quickly on his way to what he assumed was probably a robbery gone wrong. And as he was heading there, he was updated that AFD had found a fourth body.
God, can you imagine? Like, and I've asked investigators this before, like, what's going through your mind when you're heading to a scene, like literally in the car driving to a scene? And they all kind of have this analytical, compartmentalized answer, like, we needed to wait to absorb all the information until we arrived at the location. Like, they all kind of have the same canned answer, but I truly believe that because that's how cops' brains work. They know certain information. They know it's not going to be good, but they don't want to speculate on the details. They got to prepare themselves for whatever they're walking into.
Well, like we said at the beginning, I don't like surprises, so I would have such a hard time. I would be on with the dispatcher. I'd be like, what do you know?
Yeah.
Come on. What do you got?
That's the thing, because you don't always know everything. You just know the basics. You know, fire, here's the address, and that's it. Like, they don't know sometimes.
Oh, to, like, have to walk into something almost blindly is terrifying to me.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, Jones and Mike Huckabee, a.k.a. Huck, were two of the homicide investigators that night, and Jones would end up being the lead, with Huck pretty much being the number two, like, in the number two spot. And these two guys, they had each other's back from the first night. And when they showed up, the fire was out, but the scene was still smoldering with a lot of steam and smoke billowing in the air. Huck said they were at least an ankle deep water when they entered the I can't believe it's yogurt shop. Yeah. Well, in that shop is where they found the four bodies, three of which were together towards the back of the building. And the fourth was about 15-ish feet away towards, like, the front of the building. The four victims were female. They were all nude with various bindings of their own underwear. Each one was shot in the head and burned. And again, Jones initially thought he was arriving to a robbery gone wrong, but now he has to consider that this could have been a sexually motivated crime.
Yeah, I'm not sure what would have made him think it was a robbery gone wrong.
I think just because they were heading to a strip mall late at night, what else could it be, kind of thing?
True. I guess that could be. The other thing is, when you have a crime scene that was a fire, the water that is poured on the fire to extinguish it can play a huge role in investigators not finding evidence, because you got stuff that's ruined now. You got stuff that's soaked. Things that could be important are now useless. So that's a huge problem.
Yeah, we're going to get into that, but I truly believe that that's why this crime has not been solved, because of the water. I do remember reading an article years ago that firefighters, they felt awful because they didn't realize there were going to be people in there, and they felt so bad that they did their best work. They did as well as they could, but then they realized what they had kind of destroyed evidence.
And I could be wrong about this, but I've heard people say when they know they're protecting evidence inside, they fight the fire differently.
Yes, exactly. But how are you supposed to know?
I don't know.
Well, regardless of all the opinions out there, ours included, Jones and Huck definitely deserve a huge shout out right here. They didn't know a ton about that newfangled DNA evidence, but they did know how important it can be. So when the medical examiner showed up, the ME just wanted to take the bodies. Like, just, okay, bye. And Huck was like, absolutely not. He was able to hold them off until the Texas Department of Public Safety showed up, so that way they could swab the four bodies at the scene in hopes of collecting and preserving DNA evidence.
DPS is cool to work with, for what it's worth. Yeah, they've always been very accommodating to us.
Maybe they'll want to be a guest.
Maybe.
Well, in spite of the state of the crime scene, while investigators were taking photographs, trying to dust for fingerprints, Jones knows he needs to identify these victims. So he ended up making a late night phone call to 24-year-old Reese Price. She was the manager of the I Can't Believe It's Yogurt shop, and she had just started like her week of vacation.
Can you imagine?
Oh, right. She's in the documentary on HBO, and she is so sad, like watching her. I think part of the reason I started crying. Yeah. Well, when she first took the call and was told that there had been a fire, Reese was like, all right, like that sucks, but okay. Like,
Not my money, whatever.
And again, it's well after midnight at this point. So like it didn't even dawn on her that anyone would have been inside the shop.
Right.
Like the girl should have been way long gone by then. And that's when Jones tells Reese that they had found four bodies inside, and he asked Reese if she could come to the shop and possibly identify them.
God, to put that on a 24-year-old, that's a ton of pressure, because they're probably her friends too.
We're going to get there, but it's clear that she's haunted by this still.
I believe it.
So Reese drives to the shop, and she walked into such a horrific scene. And this is where we have to go into a little bit of graphic details. When Reese arrived on the scene, she said it was just chaos with all the lights and sirens, and the media was all over the place already. So they led her through the front of the store, and when she was shown the bodies, she said, quote, there was nothing there to identify. They didn't have faces. No clothing. Fire is very destructive. It's not forgiving, end quote.
She's right.
That part of the document, when she said they didn't have faces, I got goosebumps.
Think about something in a fire. It's just, I know it's harder because it's a human being, but fire is very destructive. She's right.
Well, ultimately, the four victims were identified as the I Can't Believe It's Yogurt employees, who were 17-year-old Eliza Thomas and 17-year-old Jennifer Harbison. And then also there were Jennifer's 15-year-old sister, Sarah Harbison, and 13-year-old friend, Amy Ayers.
God, awful.
So Eliza, Jennifer, and Sarah, they were the three bodies found together in the back of the shop, all naked, gagged and bound with their own underwear, shot execution style in the back of the head with a .22 caliber bullet, and they were charred beyond recognition. Amy, the youngest one, she was the fourth victim. She was the one who was found more towards the front of the shop. She was also naked, and she had what they think was a sock was tied around her neck. Her body wasn't charred like the other girls, although her body was covered like 25-30% in second and third degree burns.
Wow.
And poor Amy had also been shot with a .22 caliber bullet, as well as a second shot to the head that had exited through her cheek and jawline.
Wonder why the second shot.
I don't know. And this part is really horrible. 15-year-old Sarah, she had been found with an ice scooper between her legs with the handle pointing to the pubic area.
So like not in her, but on the ground between her legs.
Yes.
Okay. Wow.
Which just kind of provided more indication that like a sexual assault had occurred.
And something ritualistic. This has weird vibes to it. And since we're talking about the case that haunts me, I've spent my entire career looking at crime scene photos. Like, there's no other way to say it. Like, I've looked at thousands, and that's not an exaggeration. It's morning, noon, and night, death. And I don't mean this to sound rude or insensitive, but burn victims are the worst of the worst to me. Like, that and drowning. When I have to look at pictures of people who have burned to death, it makes your stomach churn. I saw autopsy photos one time of a burn victim, and it was bright pink inside, like you or me. And then on the outside was just black as night and like a piece of charcoal. And it's the most disturbing thing I can imagine in my head in the true crime world.
Well, poor Reese had to see this. She's 24 years old, the manager of a yogurt shop. Like, this is not something she was ever going to walk in. She thought she would ever walk into.
No.
But even after seeing the girls, Reese walked through the dark, wet, and probably horribly smelling shop. She walked around with the detectives. She walked them through the closing procedures so they could get a better idea of what the girls would have been doing. And, you know, that would help them try to figure out how someone could have committed such brutality towards the girls. Mm. So the key to the store had been left in the inside lock of the front door, which Reese confirmed was very normal. Like, if there's any customers finishing up at the 11 p.m. mm-hmm. closing time, it was standard for the closers to lock the door at 10:50 so that way nobody else would come in. Right. And they would keep going down their closing checklist.
They leave the key in the door, lock it, and then just continue with their stuff, and then knowing they'll go back and take the keys later.
Yeah, especially when somebody, and like they leave it in the door so that way people can get out, I think, as well.
Okay.
Yeah. So Reese notices that the girls, like the toppings had already been put away and the yogurt machines had been cleaned, but the gaskets were still off of the machine.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a bucket and step stool ladder still out, and the sink was still filled with water.
So it sounds to me that was an indication that the girls actually did that, that it wasn't part of the crime. Mm-hmm. Like they had filled the sink to either finish dishes or washing these heads for the machines and yep. stuff, and they were interrupted by whatever happened.
Yeah, and that's pretty much what investigators thought as well. I mean, like, what else could it be?
Right.
So I want to switch gears for a second and talk a little bit about the fire. So, Ed, you know tons of random things. Do you know what temperature aluminum melts at?
I do not. No, surprisingly, that's not one of the things. I imagine it's hot, though, because think about sitting around a campfire, throw a soda can into the fire just to watch it. It barely does anything. It crinkles a little bit, but it looks fairly similar. So I assume very hot.
I don't think I've ever done that. But
oh,
so actually, aluminum needs the lowest temperature of most of the metals. Its melting point is about 1,220 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow, that's hot.
Yeah, but melting gold, the heat needs to be at least 1,974 degrees Fahrenheit. And to get steel to melt, you need to get the temp up to 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's that when they get into smelting. And
yes.
Wow.
So, of course, while looking this up, we wanted to see what the temperature was used for the cremation process. And apparently, that's usually between 1,400 and 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit. So
wow.
The biggest reason we felt it was important to mention these temperatures is because there are a lot of theories still out there about how the fire was started or was any kind of accelerant used, but mainly because of the overall timeline. The yogurt shop closed at 11 p.m. and the patrol officer radioed the smoke from the building just before midnight.
So it had to have about an hour to heat up to that extreme temperature.
Yeah. I feel like anyone who knows this case has definitely seen the billboards and the photos of the girls. And over the years, their faces have just like been stuck in time as these four teenage girls who didn't get a chance to grow up.
Yeah, it's a pretty famous image.
It's so famous. But you know what? Amy, Eliza, Jennifer, and Sarah, they were so much more than just these random four girls you see on the billboard. So I want to spend some time talking about them. Remember how I said Austin was really an eclectic city, but like most of Texas still had roots within like the ranching and cowboy way of life? Yeah. Well, these four girls were definitely a part of the ranching cowgirl way of life in Austin.
Nice.
So Amy Ayers was born January 31st, 1978 to parents Bob and Pam Ayers, but it sounds like her older brother Sean was the happiest of the family with Amy's arrival. He's in the documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And Sean talks about how he did not want a brother. He was so, so, so thrilled to have a baby sister.
That's cool.
And the Ayers were a ranching family. Like, they lived on this ranch. They grew food and raised animals. Amy had been riding horses since she was 3 years old. And
oh my gosh.
And she could just ride around all day, every day without getting bored or tired of it. Like, her dad's in it, and he said she was born in the saddle.
That's awesome.
And for her 12th birthday, Amy was given a cutting horse named Copy.
Oh my god, that's all I got was diabetes.
Happy birthday!
Also, what's a cutting horse? I've never heard of that.
I thought you might ask that, and I didn't know either, so I looked it up.
Well, that's awfully intuitive of you.
Riding a cutting horse is a type of ranch rodeo sport where the rider is trying to like separate a cow from the herd and keep it from rejoining.
Oh. Huh.
Yeah. So Sean would say there is no kid version of riding a cutting horse, and Amy was just like a natural at it. Actually, her dad talks about if he was having issues with any of the colts on the ranch, he would tell Amy to go out and ride them. And after a few days of Amy working with them, the cult would be manageable for everybody else.
She sounds like a badass little kid.
Right? She's so cute. Wow. And I love this part about Amy. She and Sean were raising pigs, and she loved her pigs so much, she would put them on a leash and take them for walks.
Okay, that's adorable.
Isn't that so cute?
Yeah.
Amy was definitely all cowgirl. She wore her cowboy hat to school. She loved animals. She wanted to be a veterinarian. She enjoyed spending her time with her family. She liked to do needlework. She raised animals. But most of all, becoming an active junior member of the local chapter of FFA, which is Future Farmers of America. And she loved spending time with her best friend Sarah at the local barn. After her death, classmates at the local middle school celebrated Amy's 14th birthday by planting and dedicating a tree to her, like in the school courtyard.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it had a memorial marker and they placed a time capsule with the tree.
That's cool. I love that because that came up in Sarah Yarbrough when they had that bench mm-hmm. with the statue yes. and her books. That's a constant reminder. And that tree will hopefully be there forever for many generations to know who this girl is.
Stop it. And Sarah's had the little dog. I'm so yes. sad.
But what a remembrance.
Yeah. Well, Amy's best friend, Sarah, is Sarah Harbison. And she was born on October 28th, 1976. And she was the second daughter to Mike and Barbara, and she was the younger sister to one of our other victims, Jennifer Harbison. So the parents would divorce a few years after Sarah was born, and the girls ended up living with Barbara and their stepfather, Skip, although their dad, Mike, was still very much a part of their lives. And Sarah, much like her best friend, Amy, was very active in the FFA. Sarah and Jennifer were actually raising lambs as their FFA project, and these girls put in the work. Like, they were going to the barn before and after school every day to take care of the animals. They were responsible for all the care. So, like, that meant they handled the feeding, the mucking of the stalls, the grooming, and anything and everything that the animals needed.
That makes you so responsible. Like, when you become a young adult and an adult, you have learned from an early age what it means to work hard. And that goes such a long way.
100%. And these girls all seemed like such hard workers. Well, on top of the FFA, Sarah was part of the student council. She also played basketball and volleyball on the school team. And a few weeks before her death, she had just started dating her new boyfriend, Mike, who had given her his gold class ring.
She reminds me of the victim. Was it Mandy Stavik, who we recently covered? She was in like a million different activities and was like good at all of them.
All of them. Every single one. Yes.
That's what she reminds me of.
Well, the Harbison girls went to Catholic school through middle school, and then they had both transferred to attend the public high school in town. So Sarah's older sister, Jennifer, she was born on May 9th, 1974, and Jennifer was definitely a spitfire kind of kid. At 5 foot, like nothing, and weighing 86 pounds, Jennifer was a star relay runner on the varsity track team. This girl was always on the move, like, she wouldn't even sit down to eat a meal because she didn't like sitting down. She thought it was a waste of time.
Yeah, she's like, I got places to be.
Exactly. Her dad had purchased a new gold manual S10 pickup truck for Jennifer with the condition that she helped drive Sarah around, which is really what led Jennifer to her job at the I Can't Believe It's Yogurt shop. Like, she used her paychecks to help with the car payments. But Jennifer loved this truck, and this truck gave her the freedom to be on the move as much as she wanted or needed to be. And Jennifer had a serious boyfriend named Sam, and the two were hoping for him to get a baseball scholarship to a school so Jennifer could go there as well, and then they were going to get married. Oh, you know, it's high school love. That's
yep.
You always think it's going to end like that. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, both of the Harbison sisters had their rooms decorated with photos of their friends, photos of like FFA and sports memorabilia, and Jennifer had made a big collage with the title, The Boots, The Jeans, The Dream, which was a big motto with barrel girls in the rodeo world.
Oh, okay. I didn't know if I was supposed to know what that meant.
No, I didn't, but I thought it was cool.
It is cool.
Well, Jennifer was rarely seen without her large face Timex watch with a thick black band. She loved that watch. Oh, and she had just been nominated for the FFA Queen.
Good for her. So I know some people like that, these kind of 4-H types. And that's a humongous honor, like the kings and queens of various festivals and events. I mean, that means a lot to them.
Yeah, and she was so excited. So our fourth victim, Eliza Thomas, she was born on May 19th, 1974. Her parents also divorced when she was 7, and she spent a lot of her time with her younger sister, Sonora. They would go back and forth a lot between their parents' homes. Mm-hmm. And at 14, her parents let her decide where she wanted to live. And after continuing to split her time, in July of 91, Eliza settled full-time with her mom. Okay. And like the rest of the girls, and despite her mom's best effort, Eliza was just as active in the FFA. She had also been nominated for FFA Queen, and she was raising a pig for her FFA project.
Wow.
And even though her mom, Maria, was much more into the arts and didn't really care for the farm world, she really did do her best to support Eliza. She even went to the barn occasionally to, like, help muck the stalls and other odds and ends.
That's hilarious. So speaking as a parent, that's really hard to do, to connect with your kid when you have nothing in common or you don't have any mutual interests and you just like very different things. So bravo to her if she was able to maintain this great relationship with her daughter. And it must have been great if Eliza chose to come live with her at 14.
Yeah. And I like the fact that they kind of respected each other's differences, but also seemed to try to learn about each other's likes and dislikes.
Yeah.
Well, Eliza had dreams of going to Texas A&M and becoming a veterinarian. And this girl was impressive. She was really mechanically inclined and she was a skilled welder.
Shut up. Really?
I know, right? Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing.
Well, it really came in handy because her most prized possession was a 1971 bright green VW Carmen Ghia.
Oh, Carmen Ghia. Oh,
a
man.
Ghia?
Yeah. They're really cool cars. So they really? I don't know if you ever saw them. Yeah, they're two-door coupes, but they have like an Italian flair. I guess that's the best way I can put it. It definitely doesn't look like a VW like that you would think of.
Yeah. Because in my head, I just think of a VW bus, but I know that there's
these are
other
sporty
VWs.
Yeah, they were sweet cars.
Eliza was like able to do a lot of the repairs that it needed all by herself.
That's really badass.
Yeah, actually, for Christmas that year, she asked for car parts, which I think is so fun for like a 17-year-old girl.
Yeah.
I was asking for like the new flip phone or whatever.
Yeah, and she's like, I'll take a crankshaft for a 1970 whatever
exactly.
Carmen Ghia.
Well, Eliza had been working at ICBY, I can't believe it's yogurt, mostly on the weekends, but occasionally picking up weekday evening shifts just to earn some money for herself. But she also wanted to help her mom out with some of the bills and the groceries.
I absolutely love that. Mm-hmm. But it sucks at the same time to know how well-rounded and hardworking all these girls were, because when this kind of stuff happens, it always seems to happen to the good ones.
That's so unfair.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to recap a little bit about what we know happened in those last 16-ish hours before the Austin Fire Department found the girls in the aftermath of the fire. So all four of the girls attended school. Again, Amy went to the middle school, while Sarah, Jennifer, and Eliza, they all went to the barn to tend to their animals before school, and then they went to the local high school afterwards.
Okay.
So after school, Jennifer drove Sarah home and dropped her off, and then she went to see her boyfriend, Sam. He didn't go to school that day because he had been at his grandfather's funeral. So,
sad.
She wanted to stop in and say hi and check on him.
Sure.
So then Jennifer stopped by her friend's house to grab her wallet. She had left it there a couple of days prior, and then she had to swing back to school to pick up a form to fill out for the FFA Queen. And then she finally returned home. So she ran a whole bunch of errands like right after school. And while all this is going on, Sarah was sitting on the couch eating an orange when their mom got home. And Sarah was in a really good mood. And she told her mom all about her plans for the night. She was going to go with Amy to the North Cross Mall to hang out. And then they were going to have a sleepover. Well, when Jennifer got home, their mom remembers her being a little bit evasive as she ran upstairs to get changed into her work uniform. And at the time, her mom kind of assumed it was because Jennifer had been with Sam, and mom kind of suspected that they had recently taken their relationship to the next level and become sexually active.
Fair.
So her mom would later be proven correct in that assumption, as Sam's DNA had been collected from Jennifer's body later that night.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, soon after, Jennifer and Sarah were out the door, and I'm really happy for their mom about this last moment she got with them. The girls had one last chance to hug their mom goodbye while being able to say, I love you, as they got into that S10 truck.
What better thing could you say to someone if it's the last time you're going to see him? That's huge.
Ugh, I can't imagine those parents losing their two kids.
I know. Yeah, it's your worst nightmare.
Yeah. Well, when Sarah left, she had a $5 bill in her wallet. She had Mike's ring on. She had her Mickey Mouse watch on. And as always, she was wearing this gold cross necklace. When Jennifer left, she was in her ICBY white uniform shirt, dark pants, black sneakers, and as always, her black Timex watch. So the girls went to pick up Amy, who had been wearing her brother's leather bomber style jacket, which actually that never was recovered.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, to this day, like, they have no idea what happened to it. Weird. So Jennifer dropped Amy and Sarah off at the mall, which was located about 2 to 3 blocks from the yogurt shop. And then Jennifer arrived at the yogurt shop on time to start her shift at 8 p.m. So Eliza had also been in a really good mood that day when she got home from school, since she too had found out about being nominated for FFA Queen.
Yeah.
This part, it makes me really happy for her mom, as well as like the other girls' moms. Like, Eliza had asked her mom to go to the barn with her after school that day because she needed to give her pig Stony an injection. And with this pig being like 250 pounds, she needed an extra set of hands. And despite we know that this was not like her mom's favorite thing to do, but she went with Eliza and they enjoyed that little bit of time together.
Can you imagine? So I'm picturing Eliza's mom as this person who like has no business inside a barn, but then these two are like manhandling this gigantic pig. That had to be like a core memory that stuck with the two of them.
Yeah, it's kind of comical when you think about it.
Yeah, that's really funny.
When the two of them got home, Eliza got changed and she got to the yogurt shop because she started her shift at 7 p.m. that night.
Okay.
So I've come across a couple sources saying Jennifer went to pick up Sarah and Amy from the mall, but others say that the girls walked the 2 to 3 blocks to the yogurt shop. I don't really think it's a major deal either way, but Sarah and Amy were at the shop and they ended up getting a pizza and just kind of hanging out. And they were going to help Jennifer and Eliza with their closing duties because, you know, then the plan was for Jennifer to drive the three of them back to their house for a sleepover.
Right.
Yeah. So Maria, Eliza's mom, she had actually stopped in the shop at about 9:30 p.m. that night. And Eliza was on the phone with her little sister, Sonora. She was trying to convince her to ride her bike to the shop to come hang out, too, which is something they had been like they had done a million times before. And the only reason Sonora didn't go was because her dad wasn't home and she didn't have his permission.
Yo, that's nuts, because what if she would have came too?
Oh, yeah. She's in the documentary and she has even said she would have been the fifth victim that night.
I could see any kid her age just being like, I don't have dad's permission, but I'm going to go anyway. And then
go real
think
quick.
About what
I'll get
happened.
Back before he. Yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Well,
scary.
According to ICBY regulars who were still at the shop, like around closing time, they were able to confirm that Eliza locked the front door, she flipped the sign to close, and the girls started their closing duties. And according to the register records, Eliza keyed in a no sale at 11:03 p.m., which at this point still cannot be confirmed if that was done on her own or if she was being threatened by someone as a robbery. Although we should note that the money from the register was ultimately missing.
Yeah, because that's like you can do that if you just need change for yourself. Like you want to change this 20 into a couple fives. So it could have been her. But it's to me, the fact that money's missing is a sure sign that robbery was the motive and that the other stuff was all kind of an afterthought, which is sick because think about this. Whoever would have done this had 4 girls to deal with. And seriously? Like, I'm not sure if one or all of them were sexually assaulted, but you have to tie them up. You have to control them. And so I'm thinking multiple suspects right away. And you do what you're going to do, and then you torch the place to kind of cover up the crime scene. So it's super risky, even at 11 o'clock at night, in my opinion.
No, I totally agree. It's such a risky crime. I still don't know how we don't know who did it.
Yeah.
Well, during the crime scene investigation, Jennifer's body was found the closest to the melted steel shelves. And there were like exploded cans of toppings. There were cleaning supplies. And there was some paint around her. And her Timex watch stopped at 11:48 p.m., marking the time of the fire's most intense heat.
Yeah, then you have, so now we know 1103 is when that no sale was made, and then 1148. Mm-hmm. So now your window's getting even tighter. So again, 45 great for the investigation.
Minutes. What?
Yeah.
How did this all go so wrong in 45 minutes?
Unreal.
Well, Sarah had been found about 3 feet from Jennifer. Her clothing was in a neat pile by the back door with her Mickey Mouse watch, Mike's class ring, and her wallet that still had that $5 in it, while her gold cross necklace had melted around her neck. So this was an incredibly hot fire, and had it not been reported when it was, any evidence that they were able to collect would have absolutely been destroyed.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's so hard to tell what's even evidence at that point, because again, everything's soaking wet.
Yeah. Good luck. It's covered in soot. It's soaking wet. It's just all so damaged at that point.
Yeah.
Well, Jones and Huck absolutely had their work cut out for them. The homicide team started by digging into the girls' lives. No matter where they looked or what they looked for, the girls just came up annoyingly squeaky clean, they said. The boyfriends, Sam and Mike, they were very quickly ruled out. And even at one point, they made positive identifications about some of the belongings that were recovered. Eliza had actually just recently broken up with her boyfriend, and even though he had been messing around, like messing with her a little bit, like he had one of his friends call the yogurt shop the night before when she was working and ask about every single flavor and the toppings they carried, because teenage boys are teenage boys. But he too was very quickly ruled out.
That's so petty, and I'm here for it. Like, I love it because it's harmless, you know? It's like, break up with me, I'll show you.
I'm going to call and ask every flavor you have.
That's, I mean, that's
funny. I would have done that shit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Jones and Huck were able to track down every customer that had paid with like a check, because you could still pay for things with check then.
You still can, Melissa.
That's so weird. Who has a checkbook?
You can go to Giant and pay with a check, but go ahead.
I did not know that. Well, they were able to track down every customer that had paid with check or card that night while asking anyone who had gone in for yogurt to please come forward to be interviewed. And this did provide a few strong leads. So one customer, she had gone in about 8:30 p.m. to get a strawberry sundae for her husband. And when she walked in, Eliza was at the register and Jennifer was taking and then making the orders. And this woman, she noticed two young men sitting at a table by the front door. One was sort of standing while the other was sitting with his back to her, and they were kind of like huddled over a bag. And she said she didn't know what was in it, but it sounded a bit like a bag of marbles clinking around.
It's weird.
Yeah, weird. But she did tell police, like, she got a very uneasy feeling about the whole situation, and she almost asked the girls, you know, if they were okay, but she just kind of ended up shaking the feeling off, and she left with her husband Sunday.
I don't think it would stand out to me as strange. Like, if I saw two teenagers huddled over a bag, I don't know if I'd think anything of it.
I don't know if I'd even notice. I'm just so in my own world.
Yeah.
Well, another customer that night had said that about 10:30 p.m., he saw a man in a car pull up in front of ICBY, not in a parking spot, though, but pulled up to the curb right in front of the shop, and he's just sitting in his car while it's idling. And it almost looked like he was casing the shop. By the time she was leaving, though, the white car was gone.
See, same thing with this, though. Like, I don't necessarily think this is suspicious. Like, my eyesight sucks. I'll pull up right on the curb if I want to, like, look at the hours of a store or something.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I could be confused. You know what I mean? But I guess when something of this magnitude happens, you want to go back and think of everything that happened that night that could be suspicious to maybe help point the investigators in some kind of direction.
See, that I would have thought was weird. However, you saying that made me think, like, maybe they had the menu in the window and he was trying
that's
to
what
see
I mean.
What...
And he was reading.
Yeah,
so,
that's true. Well, another witness tip was from the couple that had come in the shop, like, right around closing time. They were regulars and very familiar with the girls, and they actually also ended up with an uneasy feeling. So while they were eating their yogurt, they noticed two guys, like late teens or early 20s, and the guys were sitting at a table closer to the counter, and between the two of them, they had one drink. So one of the guys had gone up to the counter like he was going to order, but he ended up getting like flustered, and he decided to let the couple go before him for their order. But then when he did get up for his turn, he ended up just asking to use the restroom instead of actually ordering anything.
Maybe he was like trying to flirt with one of them and just.
And just nervous.
Yeah, I got nervous and left. Got cold feet.
Could be. Could be. So I just kind of want to explain the shop a little bit, like for reference. So when you walk into the shop, there are booths along the left wall, and then there's other tables in the main area. The counter of the store, it's towards the back, and it's kind of like you start at the left wall for your order, and then you go down the counter picking your toppings, and then the register is at the right end of the counter. So you start here, you go down the line, and then you end up at the end, and that's where you pay.
Yeah, you pay by weight, too. They put it on a scale, because you can. That's why you can put whatever toppings you want on it, and they just, here's what it costs.
Yeah, you gotta pick the lightweight toppings.
Boba, it's the way to go.
Yeah. So then there's a little hallway after the counter that goes towards the back of the shop, and on the left is where like the sinks and storage would be, and on the right is where the bathrooms are. And if you keep going past the bathrooms, you get to the back doors of the shop, and on the left was the office, but that was kept locked unless a manager was in there.
Okay.
So the guy went past the register towards the bathroom and out of the customer's sight, and a few minutes later he was back at the table with his friend. So as the regular customers were finishing and ready to leave, Eliza walked them to the door to let them out, because remember, the girls locked the door a couple minutes before 11.
Mm-hmm.
And this couple, they actually asked Eliza, are you girls like going to be okay? Like, is everything good? And they kind of gestured with their head like towards the boys.
Mm-hmm.
And Eliza didn't even seem fazed by them, though. She's like, no, like, we're good. And the couple was like, okay. So they just left with Eliza locking the door behind them. They even looked back at the shop a few times while walking and getting into their car, but they just sort of put it out of their minds and they went home.
But what was it about them? Like, they weren't that suspicious.
I guess they were.
Hmm.
You don't get it. I get it because I worked alone at the tanning salon, like, late at night. And, like, there's certain people that just come in, and I had people be like, are you okay? Like, do you want me to stay? Like, I've had people actually sit in the tanning salon until other customers tanned and left because they felt so uncomfortable with me being by myself there.
Interesting. I could see that, especially if it's a group of young girls where you don't see any male manager or some kind of older person there. You know, I could see that.
Right. Well, there were so many calls that came in from the public with a ton of different tips. There are two other ones that I want to mention, though. So a woman called in saying that about 4 days prior to the murders, she had been in the shop and she noticed a younger 20-something-year-old man. He was like average build and height with wavy, blondish, shoulder-length hair, and he was standing by the freezers. But instead of looking at any of the items, it seemed like his eyes were fixated down the hallway, like on the back doors of the shop.
Hmm.
And she said that he made her really uneasy and she just wanted to get out of there.
Wow.
Which is creepy.
Yeah.
So another tip that they got, it was actually from the night of the murders, like earlier that night. And it was from this guy. His name was Darley Croft. He was a 54-year-old former police officer. And he was actually the current owner of a security company. And he had gone to ICBY that night after being out for dinner. So he walks in and he kind of did like mental surveillance of the shop, which, you know, once a cop, always a cop.
Yeah.
So he saw a young couple having yogurt. He saw the girls eating pizza. He saw Jennifer on the phone and Eliza was talking to her mom because remember her mom stopped in.
Right.
Well, this guy, he also noticed a fidgety young man in a green jacket. It looked like it could have been from, like, a military surplus store, one of those kind of jackets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Army, Navy.
Yeah. And the guy was younger, 20s, white, medium build, and around 5'10", maybe 6 foot. And something just seemed off about this guy.
What is with all these shady characters and 20-somethings gathered at ICBY that night? Like, it's tailor-made for a crime show. For real.
Who knew it was such a hotbed for perverts?
Honest to God.
Perverts don't wear signs that say they go to yogurt shops. So this guy, he was in front of Darley in line. And when it was the guy's turn, he didn't step up to the counter. So Darley shuffled forward a bit and the guy turned around and just ended up asking Darley, is that your car out there? And remember, Darley was driving a company car because he was in the security business. and it had blue lights fixed to the top of it. Mm-hmm. And Darley responded, yeah. And this guy asked more questions, and he's like, are you a cop? Security? What are you? And again, this all seemed really odd to Darley, but he did tell the guy he owned a security company. So the guy finally steps up to the counter and asks Jennifer for a soda. By the time Darley finished giving his orders and like got to Eliza to pay, he asked her where that guy went, to which Eliza said, to the bathroom. And Darley knew Eliza and her mom from the gym, and, you know, he was also a regular. So he was kind of trying to stall for time. He started chatting a little with Eliza and her mom, but by the time Jennifer had his order ready, he didn't really have much of a reason to hang out much longer because he wanted to see what this guy's deal was.
Yeah.
So he's kind of like, all right, it's just going to look weird if I start standing here. So he started to head out, and we're going to talk about this more next week. But actually, in 1999, Darley was brought in to look at a 4-page line of photos to see if anyone was the guy he testified to seeing that night. But he did not pick out any of the photos shown to him as, like, that weird guy.
See, now this guy sounds shady as hell, too. Like, what is going on at this yogurt shop?
I don't know. Why are there so many creepers?
I don't get it.
Well, there are plenty of other tips we could talk about, but I know we need to keep this moving. I just want to highlight that most of the stores in the shopping center were all closed by like 9 or 10 p.m., with the yogurt shop staying open until 11 p.m., and people definitely went in that late, so there was still a decent amount of people that could account for what was going on between like 9:30 and 10:45 that night.
And I feel like that it's going to turn out to be people who knew the time they closed. Like, this was a calculated plan, I guess, that had some thought put into it to hit the yogurt shop that night, not just a crime of opportunity.
Seems so dangerous to leave 17-year-old girls in charge of, like, to walk to their car at night. Like, I hate everything about this.
That's the way it was. I mean, I don't know if it's still like that. Maybe things have changed a little bit, but I remember working fast food when I was a kid. You closed up and you left. It was you and two buddies from high school.
I don't know. It just seems like so asking for trouble. Like, not the kid's fault. It's whoever's the manager.
Right.
But
sometimes there's no manager there.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, how are you going to leave two children in charge of your store? I just feel like, I get that it still happens now. I just feel like it's so dumb.
Yeah, we would close up all the time and then steal a bunch of food. But
of course you would.
You get a free 6-inch for every couple hours you work. Yeah, I was a Subway. I was a sandwich artist.
A sandwich artist?
I'm this old. They used to cut the V's out of the tops of Subway sandwiches. It wasn't a 3-foot-longs for $10.
Can't wait. So now we have Jones and Huck going through every single tip that's coming in. They're talking to anyone and everyone in the days after the murders. The officers put microphones and an undercover cop, like, all over the joint funeral that was held for the girls. And some of the witnesses actually had been hypnotized to try to help with their memories and to get the composites drawn.
That was big back then.
Well, and in the documentary, they talk about how they did a lot of things that really they had never done before, like going to the funeral. That was one of the first funerals they went to just to see if anyone would be there.
I'm surprised a psychic wasn't involved.
I know, right? People in the 90s loved psychics, but not for crimes.
No.
So a $25,000 reward had been raised by the community, and the families were staying very much in the public eye. They had billboards put up all over Austin, and smaller versions of the billboards were put on almost every taxi cab in the city, which is such a good idea.
Yeah.
Well, by June of 92, so about 6 months later, the reward fund had been increased to $100,000.
Wow.
Which, just for reference, like, for 2025, money is just shy of $240,000.
I believe that. That's a ton of money for then.
Yeah. And so naturally, a flood of calls came in when that reward was announced.
But that means a flood of information that people have to sift through, that is 99% of it is garbage.
Yep. Well, throughout this investigation, Jones and his team had obtained something wild, like 6 written and 40 verbal confessions.
Jeez.
But since Jones and Huck had kept quite a few details to themselves, every time they reviewed any of these confessions, it was obvious they were false because they didn't match the facts. So no arrests were made.
Yeah, that's something else you saw a lot of in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Well, at this point, the entire city is on edge and people wanted answers. And sort of like in a witch hunting kind of way, the community started to turn on those living in the counterculture groups, aka the PIBs.
Oh, so Indian broadcasters were looking over their shoulders?
Something like that. Well, rumors that the murders were for like a gang initiation or part of the occult, because, you know, the 90s, the late 80s and 90s, everybody loved to blame Satanism.
Yeah.
But there were also rumors about it being like ritualistic, and these rumors are just getting louder and louder.
Yeah, well, this has all the makings of something ritualistic or gang ties.
Mm-hmm. There were 6 people on the homicide team working through close to 2,000 tips, and they had roughly 350 suspects to work through.
Wow. Person who did this is on that list somewhere. I'm just saying it now. Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Well, at one point, they got into the world of vampires, dance club kids, the grunge PIBs, and the name Claire LeVay kept coming up. She was like kind of a leader in some of those fringe groups and ultimately had her home aggressively raided. And even worse, the cops had the crew from 48 Hours with them when this happened. So this whole thing ended up being nationally televised.
Yeah, that's crazy. Do you remember the Boston case, Carol Stewart, where the guy ended up jumping off the bridge? That Rescue 911 was along with them. And I thought that was some of the most intriguing footage, because you're there to do a TV show. You're there to bring the crew along with your day-to-day stuff. But then imagine having them along when something monumental happens. It's just pure luck.
Wild. Yeah, seriously. Well, while the cops were in Claire's home, they found a box that had like an almost mummified skull and bones in it.
Oh my
God.
And
the cops were like, all right, she's it. We got this. Like, case closed.
Game over.
But it turns out it was nothing more than really macabre decor. It was like a plastic skull with weathered leather and hair glued to it. Like, cool.
Almost creepier than a real skeleton.
I know. Well, finally, in October of 1992, the absolute biggest break came in the case, and it came out of Mexico. So random. So a man by the name of Saavedra, aka the Terminator, he was arrested in Mexico, and he actually confessed to the murders in Austin, and he implicated 2 other men.
Wow.
And honestly, Texas, along with like the rest of the country, was so hopeful that this is where justice for Amy, Eliza, Jennifer, and Sarah was going to come. One of the men, by the name of Cortez, he closely resembled the composite, and he fit the tip from the witness about seeing a man in the white car pulled up outside of the shop. Remember the guy we said maybe he's looking at the menu? Yeah. So in Saavedra's confession, he went on to say that they tied up the first girl with ropes and made her undress. Using her underwear, they tied the next girl up, having her undress and repeating this for all 4 of the girls. And they said that they had hit and beat the girls to keep them quiet as this was happening.
Jesus.
He then confessed to shooting the girls and then using white gas, which was actually kerosene, to start the fire.
I mean, so far it matches, right?
Right. So these 3 guys are arrested in Mexico, and due to the extradition laws back in 92, the men would have to be tried in Mexico for the crimes. Mexico didn't have the death penalty, where we know Texas did and still does, and the people of Texas, they wanted this to be a capital punishment case, and I'm with them on that one.
Same, yeah. They deserve whoever did this deserves it.
100%. But an arrest is better than no arrest, so Huck was the one who got sent to Mexico to interview and review the confessions of these men, and it became so clear very quickly that this was just another false confession. First of all, there are no ropes or any kind of material used to bind the girls aside from their own underwear. And the confession also mentioned the wrong caliber gun, and that white gas he was talking about, that was wrong too.
Really? So they were seeing things on the news and reading it?
Yeah, for sure. And for the record, only a few officers, and obviously the killers, they're the only ones who know how the fire was started, as this detail has been still kept from the public. Saavedra finally publicly and tearfully recanted his confession, saying that the Mexican federal police forced him to make the confession. He said they handcuffed him, put a bag over his head, beat him, and even threatened to harm his family if he didn't confess.
That's strange. And I know there was a lot going on in the 80s and 90s between Mexico and the U.S. with the DEA, the cartels, all that. And they have been known to do some pretty nasty stuff to people.
It ended up being a dead end, and just kind of like pretty much every other lead that they had been trying to track down. Yeah. So Jones and Huck had stayed on this case, and they ended up getting really close with the families, especially Bob Ayers, Amy's dad. He's in the documentary, and he is one of those big, tough cowboys who breaks down into tears. It was so sad. And this case actually took a really heavy toll on Sergeant Jones in particular. The families eventually started to urge Jones and Huck to seek help. Like, the families telling them to go get help. They were like, you need to go talk to someone to help you deal with this, because you guys are humans too.
Well, think about the amount of suspects they're weeding through, and how many tips did you say? Thousands? I mean,
yeah,
it'll kill you.
Well, and I think that they just like almost like fell in love with these girls, like their families love them, you know, like they heard all the stories. There's so many home videos.
Yeah.
Jones actually ended up getting a divorce, and his children chose to live with his ex-wife. And then Jones also ended up being diagnosed with PTSD. He would go on to suffer from nightmares, and he had certain like exposure triggers. And there were certain things like anniversaries or birthdays that would really trigger him. And he had a significantly lessened range of emotions. Like, he was feeling very flat all the time.
Can you blame him?
No, not at all. He suffered from insomnia, irritability, and an increased startle response, which is not something you think about, but yeah, I 100% get it. And because of all this, plus like a combination of a few other reasons, in May of 94, the Austin Police Department removed Jones from the case, and they transferred him to a whole different division.
Probably best.
Yeah. And at that point, the original six-member task force was pretty much ended. And the case, while it was always open, it definitely moved towards like the cold side of the room. And it had to start getting less priority than it had for the last 2.5 years.
Wow.
Well, that, my friend, is where we are going to end today's episode, because this has been a lot. And those poor girls, I feel like that billboard is just burned into my brain forever.
Yeah. Well, but the case that haunts us, you know, it's a case that will just stick with you, even though we have no ties to it whatsoever.
God, I hope it gets solved.
I know. And this, what it did to, this is a great example, and I'm glad we're bringing this up for this block, because look at what it did to that poor investigator. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is just the guy who worked it.
It essentially ruined his life.
Yeah. You guys let us know what you think about part one. Do you think that any of the shady 20-year-olds that were in the yogurt shop had something to do with this? The amount of people that could be involved in this, I think they're in the case file.
Yeah, I could see that. And I mean, there does end up being arrests in this case, and people go to jail, but they get exonerated.
Yeah,
that we're definitely going to talk about next week, because there's still people who think that they're guilty. I think it's crazy that all these years later, we still don't know how the fire was started.
But like, why not say it? And you wonder if that's a product of all these false confessions they were getting, like the more people that can confess with more details.
Yeah.
You know,
I don't know. Well, let us know what you guys think. You can hit us up on our socials at Murder Unscripted. You can email us at murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com, or you can let us know what you think on our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com.
Well, yeah, great job, Melissa. And I'm definitely looking forward to part two. And I may tell that one just because you did a lot of the victimology. So if you're cool with it, maybe I'll host that one.
I think you should.
Oh, okay. Maybe I will.
Maybe I'll allow it. Anyway, we hope everyone stays safe, stay hydrated, and remember, the perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
Whoever did this crime is the king of perverts, and I think it was multiple people, so multiple perverts.
Well, and now we know that perverts hang out, like they like frozen yogurt, evidently.
Yeah, I mean, I do too.
I like regular ice cream, so I'm not a pervert like you.
There you go.
See ya. Bye.